You ready? We're going.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:30, 1:30. We're in the time of how long it takes us today. April 10th, 2015. With me today is Senator Geisel, Senator Stoltz, and Senator Ellis, and myself, Stedman. We have a quorum to conduct business. On the agenda today, there's a couple of bills. Senate Bill 98, an act relating to the diagnosis, treatment, and prescription of drugs without a physician's examination. Next up after that will be Senate Bill 65, an act relating to juvenile justice proceedings and amending Rule 21, Alaska Delinquency Rules of Procedure. And we'll have an ADs. First, we're going to go into previously heard bills. First up is Senate Bill 78, Medical Assistance Coverage, reformed by the governor. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 78, version 29, GS1055-alpha from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection?
Mr. Chairman, just for a 10-second comment.
Yes.
Not to slow things out, but moving this out, understanding that this will be accompanied by cost containment reform measures as well. That's it.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Seeing no objections, we'll move this bill from committee to the next committee referral. Next up, at the request of Senator Stoltz, Senate Bill 74, reform of the system, Medicaid system, by Senator Kelly. We have a motion. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for Senate Bill number 74, version 29, LS0692-India from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move that bill from committee, the next committee referral. Next up, Senate Bill 90, Medicaid, used durable equipment, by Senator Stoltz. Senator Stoltz, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 90 be moved from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move that bill from committee. Next up, Senate Bill 53, Advanced Practice Nurses, Registered Nurses, by Senator Geisel. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill number 53, version 29, LS0043-November from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we move that bill from committee. Next up, House Bill 4, Automated External Defibrillation. Do we have a motion? By Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill number 4, version 29, LS0027-alpha from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move that bill to the next committee referral. And just for the record, we've previously had public hearings on all five of those bills over the last several days, in particular Senate Bill 74, the reform bill. We spent a lot of time working on that. With that, I'd like to thank the committee for their work on those five bills, and the labor will continue this afternoon. We're going to start with Senate Bill 98.
Mr. Chairman, brief at ease.
Yes, we'll have a brief at ease. back on the record, we previously announced a couple bills. I got ahead of the calendar a little bit. We won't be hearing Senate Bill 53 or House Bill 4. That's Monday's agenda item. Today, as advertised, was House Bill 8, Powers of Attorney, and then followed by House Bill 72, Designated Caregivers for Patients. So we got that straightened out. So here we'll go with House Bill 8. If we could have the sponsor come forward, Representative Hughes, I'm sorry for the confusion. You were probably gasping for air, thinking that your bill was going to be heard today and there was skullduggery going on, but there really wasn't. If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Shelley Hughes from District 11, the Greater Palmer area, and I'm glad I stuck around. I was about ready to leave the room thinking we weren't going to happen today. So thank you for hearing my bill. This has been a work that's been underway for a couple of years from a lot of input, particularly from the seniors in Alaska, and we have support of both AARP and the conservative senior group, and its name is slipping my mind, Mature Americans, Association of Mature Americans. And so I'll just go back in my district and around the state. We've heard stories of financial scams targeting adults, vulnerable adults, and they're unfortunately far too common. And sadly, they often involved a person the vulnerable adult knows because they've been granted a power of attorney. And older Alaskans happen to be more susceptible to fraud and financial abuse because often they experience some sort of cognitive decline that may be through natural causes or medications, and they can have difficulty understanding their changing world. And last year in Alaska, there were more than 600 allegations of financial exploitation between several units in our state government, the Adult Protective Services Division, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and the Office of Public Advocacy and Elder Fraud Unit. And as an example, in the Elder Fraud Unit, which was actually a smaller number of cases, more than half of them were related to a power of attorney abuse. And just out of that smaller grouping alone, there were an average of one in every 2 weeks a senior finding themselves in a legal interaction. So lots of things being filed in the courts because of problems with a power of attorney. And one of the common methods of abuse is the misuse of the power of attorney that a person's granted. And so what HB 8 does, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it strengthens Alaska's existing power of attorney statutes by clarifying the responsibility of the person receiving the power of attorney and approving the form itself. And while keeping our statute customized for the state of Alaska, our unique and specific circumstances for our state, it also aligns some of the wording with that of other states, which is helpful in this day and age when sometimes we have a state border dividing us, whether we are the one caring for a vulnerable adult in Alaska, if it's the reverse as far as where the parties live. And so there's new terminology in the bill, and one of them is actually just the two simple terms, which I'll tell you. The principal is the person granting the power of attorney, and then the agent is the person who is granted the power of attorney or receives the power of attorney. And there's also a new definition for signing that my staff ginger will tell you about to allow a little more flexibility there. The agent's duties are very clearly defined so that they know what their role is, and there's no confusion going in. The form itself instructs the principal to assign everything to the The current form instructs the principal to assign everything to the agent unless specifically crossing out, and now the bill would change that so that when the principal would need to mark yes or no for each category so that they're going through and thinking about each thing that they're assigning. It also separates out a special section of items that we refer to as hot powers, which are very elevated things that a person needs to think about very seriously. They're more significant than routine financial actions, and Ginger will go over that. Judicial relief is also a new section. It will further protect the principal by allowing a list of qualified persons that can petition the court to review the agent's conduct. And then there's also a new section about substitute decision-making documents, which allows for recognition of documents between states on a temporary basis, for instance, when someone is going on a vacation. So all in all, it allows, the HB 8 allows for better definition, clarifies the area of concern, and will help the principal make better decisions when it comes to assigning these important responsibilities of their finances and property to someone. And we honor our elders in this state, and this, and we have an obligation to the vulnerable adults. And so I believe this bill will strengthen our existing statutes to better protect them and better guide those also who help care for them. And so I believe it's very important that we make these statute changes and improve the power of attorney, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And if, yeah, I was just going to say, Ginger Blaisdell, my staff, can walk you through the sections of the bill if you'd like.
I think that would be helpful. We've got a 41-pager here, and I know Ginger's worked on a lot of bigger bills over her career, so she could help the committee. That would be appreciated.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Hughes. And the two documents that I'll look at or walk you through is the bill, which is version N.A. And then this document that's a section analysis. And I'll just walk you through quickly, and 41 pages hopefully will go by fairly quickly. On page one, the very first item on line six is the definition of agent. And so that clearly describes the person who is now receiving the powers of financial authority for another individual. Section 2 adds the United States Virgin Islands, and that's just a technical change that we're making to a lot of statutes to make sure that we're including all of the United States and their territories. Section 3 identifies a number of other definitions. And a couple of things that are more current. One is defining electronic, because we do a lot of financial transactions electronically now that maybe we weren't doing in 1998 when this bill was last, or when this legislation was last looked at. The principal, like Representative Hughes stated, is the person who owns the money, owns all the items, and is giving someone authority to act on their behalf. Changing the definition of the word sign was a very important piece, and this was something that was brought to our attention by a senior center. They had clients who they were helping review a power of attorney and create a power of attorney. Sometimes those clients weren't able to actually create their own signature, whether it was arthritis, maybe a stroke. Mentally, they were completely competent to understand what they were doing, but physically not able to sign. And so now the signature allows you to either make some kind of a tangible symbol, might be an X, might be a check mark, whatever they might be able to do, or they might be able to instruct another person to sign on their behalf and to make that indicator for them. It would be done in front of a notary, so the notary would be able to witness that that was truly the intent of the principal. Section 4 is the agent's acceptance and liability, and this basically says that if you agree to be the agent, that you also are liable, and if you behave fraudulently, you may have to repay the principal's assets back to their original state. And on the bottom of page 2, starting on line 29, this was also a very important piece that had not been in our power of attorney statutes before. And this is describing the agent's duties. So now when you sign up to be the agent, it's not just I get a blank check. It's you actually have some responsibility. It means that you're going to be loyal to the principal. You're going to act on their behalf, how they would normally manage their finances. You keep a record of receipts. As you can see, there's a number of ways that you act in good faith and you act with good morals. And that goes on for about 2.5 pages of behaving appropriately. On page 4, let me just jump to that. Acceptance of the power of attorney. This pertains to the third party individual accepting and recognizing a power of attorney as a correct document. So if you were to walk into your, let's just say I'm the power of attorney for my parent, and I was walking into my mother's bank, and I had the power of attorney, they should accept that as being a legal document, unless they have some really valid reason to question whether or not I should be signing off on her documents. That way you can still conduct business, and the third party needs to be able to accept this document. Termination of a power of attorney is on page 4. Oh, page 6, sorry.
Line 10.
Yes, line 10. or line 12. So termination of a power of attorney, I think I have that wrong because we made an adjustment in here. So termination says that if the principal dies, you should no longer be taking care of their effects. And upon death, the difference between that is that sometimes the will will take over instead of the power of attorney. And the will might have different instructions and might have a different person managing all of the assets there. That's one of the most significant pieces there, is when it would terminate. Section 5 on page 7 is validity of a power of attorney executed in another state. And what this says is that Alaska will accept a power of attorney and recognize it as long as it follows state statutes that are from another state but similar to ours, and that we can accept that. Maybe not a quick generic download off of the internet, but certainly something that's authorized by another state. And then starting on page 7, section 6 is actually the statutory form for a power of attorney. And this instructs anybody who's going to develop one, whether you're a law firm or there is one group that puts it online. And this is one that Representative Hughes touched on. In the statutory form, it used to have a whole list of financial transactions you would be responsible for, one signature at the bottom, and you get everything. And what one of the senior centers highlighted to us is that this is a problem because a lot of times people just want to sign the bottom because they're a little overwhelmed by a big list of legal-looking language. Sometimes the person signing off their power of attorney didn't understand all of the pieces that they were actually giving away. A lot of these are pretty important. You know, your largest asset, your home, you're giving somebody the power to take care of all your real estate transactions. You manage bank accounts, you manage retirement accounts, a number of things. What we've changed is that we're asking that the principal select yes or no for each item. So at least they've had an opportunity to read and hopefully understand or have the chance to ask a question about each item that they would be signing off to someone to take care of. If they mark two yeses, it automatically negates it. Or if they mark a yes and a no, it automatically negates it. They say it's not clear enough, so we won't accept that one. And if they don't mark either, it's considered a no, and so they would not be accepted. On page 9 are what we had referred to as hot powers. And that's the grant of specific authority. These items used to be part of that one blanket signature authorization. And now we've separated them so that the person has to specifically indicate they would allow their agent to make these changes. These are things like creating, changing, or revoking a trust. It could change the beneficiaries. It could be granting a gift. There are a number of rather significant financial changes that a person would select here. We also have improved a definition, and you'll see the first changes happening on page 10 in the middle of the page, where the word disability is removed and the word incapacity is put in its place. There are a lot of people who may have a disability, but they're completely cognitive and can manage their finances. But when a person becomes incapacitated, they usually can't comprehend exactly what they're doing. And so the power of attorney would come into effect at a different point in time. Again, it has to be witnessed by a notary. And I'll just kind of insert a little bit here. Because we changed the definition to sign, a notary signs an oath that says, I've witnessed the signature of this individual. Because we changed how somebody can sign, they might not be witnessing the person's signature. And so a floor amendment done just before it came to this committee allows a new definition for what a notary can witness as being the signature of the individual. So whether it's an electronic signature, whether it's another person signing on their behalf, as long as that notary feels confident they can comprehend what they're doing. Okay. Section 8 that starts on page 12 talks about if they fail to mark the yes or the no, that it defaults to no because it was not a clear enough instruction at that point.
If we could just stop there.
Yes.
The first hearing on the bill, so depending on how it goes, but I'd like you to get with my office on Section 7 dealing with the notary issue you just brought up.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add, that provision has the sideboards around it that it only, for the notary, it only applies to the signing of this, so it's not a blanket change to a notary approving signatures.
Okay. I've just seen skullduggery going on with notarized signatures that people didn't sign and things like that, so we'll want to take a look at that.
Okay. And Chairman, this, the attention of the definition of to sign and that the notary might not be able to witness an actual signature was brought to our attention by the Office of Public Advocacy. One of the attorneys in the Elder Fraud Unit thought that we needed to make sure and clarify that for this specific bill. Okay. So Section 9, which starts on page 13, what you'll see on a number of sections coming up are the descriptions of all of the items the person may have just signed yes or no on the form. And it really gives a complete definition of what does it mean when you say real estate transactions. But what you'll see is that we've removed the terms revoke, create, or modify a trust. That used to be incorporated into every action a person could make, and now we've pulled that out and made it a special hot power, so that the principal really can make that decision independently on whether or not they should have that kind of power. And that's what you'll see primarily all of the changes through the next half a dozen pages are removing the revoke, create, or modify a trust. So unless that's specifically identified, it cannot happen just in general terms. And so as we move past all of these revoke and modify trusts, on page 20, line 5, it talks about credit and debit cards and electronic transaction authorizations. So in 1998, we didn't have as much electronic financial activity as we do now. And so this is, again, bringing it into today's terms and letting the agent actually manage those transactions electronically. Okay. A few little word changes, adding the word to, so there's a little bit of just grammatical correction. And on page 23, one of the things that was happening was also that there are a number of kinds of business transactions that occur that an agent may have to deal with on behalf of the principal. And so on the bottom of page 23, we added a number of other kinds of business transactions that had typically been questioned in court. And so these are clarifying so the court doesn't have to try and interpret what was really happening. And these have only to do with managing the principal's business affairs. So it might be terminating their ownership, it might be reorganizing, it might be investing differently in that business, but it is handling their affairs. Okay, let's see where the next one is. I wanted to see if it's repeating or not. Okay, so Section 14 is talking about the agent being able to manage their insurance policy or annuities. Section 15 is a section that was originally repealed and replaced with the ability of an agent to manage gifts. And gifts, sometimes the agent will give themselves a gift. Sometimes it might be maybe a scholarship fund that the principal always had managed. So gifts take on a whole new life of their own. The reason it's repealed and reenacted is that legislative legal wanted to put it in the same format as the form so that it tracks the same pattern as the form, and it's much easier to follow. The language that was repealed will be reinstated here in just another couple of sections. On Section 16, which is on page 26, it talks about the agent managing the principal's personal relationships. And what that means is there might be a child support payment that needs to be made. There might be another dependent of some sort that they're required to manage. So it's taking the intent of the principal and helping to manage another person's finances a lot of the time. So it's transferring that money. Primarily, it had to deal with child support. Those were the largest questions when it came to powers of attorney. On page 29, line 7, this also allows the agent to act on the principal's behalf in regards to HIPAA. And so that's a new piece that needed to be added. The little piece on page 29, line 22 through 24, this is talking about dealing with an individual in civil or military service. And so it could be a military individual that they want somebody back in the stateside to keep taking care of all of their finances. Could be a spouse, could be somebody else. And it also includes the transportation and shipment of all their household effects. And that could be interstate, it could be intercountry, it could be a number of options there. Page 30, line 16, allows the agent to apply in or change or amend a benefit program. And we have all sorts of benefit programs. It could be anything from Medicaid, Medicare, could be some of their military benefits, retirement benefits. It includes an awful lot. Let's see. The next one. Section 18. This is the new subsection that, again, is granting the specific authority with respect to gift transactions. And so that's a hot power, and that is a very specific authority. And it goes into further description on gifts. Page 32 is, again, replacing the term disability or incompetence to incapacity. And
can we pick the pace up a little bit?
Yep, we sure can. So the last couple of things I'll just highlight instead of just going line by line. I'm going to skip that one. On page 34, and this is a piece that was highly sought after by some of the senior centers that contacted us, judicial relief. This allows a number of different people to petition the courts to review an agent's actions. So if suddenly the agent is taking the family to a trip to Disneyland because they've never been before, and it's on grandma's checkbook, anyone can look at that and ask the court to question it. If the court so chooses, they could remove the agent's ability and assign a conservator. And just trying to think if there's anything else that's really, really we need to touch on. Substitute decision-making documents. This is something where if you are in one state and you have somebody in another state taking care of your effects, that the documents and the powers can be transferable. And it could even be just a vacation. If you're going down to visit one child who's in Arizona and all of your powers are done in Alaska, you can change your powers and specifically say that we'll accept, you know, we want these to take place while we're in Arizona. So could be for a medical trip or a vacation. But that is the bill. It sounds like an awful lot. What we really did was beef up the definitions of all of the terms regarding the powers of attorney. Powers of attorney statutes hadn't been updated since 1998. So we brought them current with terminology. We've improved them. We've assigned the agent's duties. We've protected them a little bit better with having some kind of judicial relief. And that is a long technical bill in a short few minutes.
And if we could have the bill sponsor update the sectional analysis page numbers and to the current version of the bill.
Yes, we certainly can do that, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to just mention, since this is the HES committee, that the one item pertaining to the HIPAA is simply about payment for health care. This is not a document about making health care decisions for someone else. That's separate from this. This is about finances and property. And the HIPAA reference was solely relating to payment for health care services.
I'll try to keep my committee members from wandering, but no guarantees. We may wander from the first page to the last page. Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor before we open up public hearing? Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing. We have one person on the off net. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, we'll start with Teresa Holt, please. If she's still on. Teresa Hope.
Hello. Yes, I just got unmuted. My name is Teresa Holt, and I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I'm testifying on behalf of this bill. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman frequently investigates cases in which family members or other friends misuse their power of attorney documents to exploit vulnerable adults, especially seniors, which we find is especially difficult since most seniors have worked most of their life and at the end of their life they're defrauded of their assets, which they had saved to take care of themselves in their old age. House Bill 8 does many things, but one of which it clarifies and updates the current definitions in the bill. It adds important protections for defining both the duties of the agent and then when that agent violates those duties, holding them liable for that. There are changes to the power of attorney form, which we are in favor of, requiring active participation in each power that you're delegating away instead of they're all there unless you cross one out, which is kind of counterintuitive. The bill also provides provisions for judicial review when someone, a principal, family member, state agency, care provider feels that the power of attorney document is being misused. The bill also clarifies when third parties must accept power of attorney documents and when they can decline. We feel this is important because the new changes encourage institutions to refuse questionable power of attorneys and to report suspected exploitation to authorities without fear of penalty. And then the last piece I'd like to testify on is it clarifies under what conditions the power of attorney document can be terminated and who they need to notify. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. That concludes the off-net, and no one has signed up in the LIOs. I'd like to bring it into the room for public testimony. Deborah, you can come forward. I didn't pronounce your last name, but I'd probably butcher it, so I'll spare myself. If you can introduce yourself for the record, sure. And who you represent.
My name is Deborah Baer, and I'm an Alaska Uniform Law Commissioner. I've been a Uniform Law Commissioner for over 20 years. I just wanted to let you know that the state of Alaska has been in Uniform Law organization since 1914, and it's a states' rights organization where all the best ideas are brought in. We have an open public process, and we came out with a bill. Page 37 to the end of the bill basically is the result of that open public process. It's the uniform recognition of substitute decision-making documents across state lines. So what that basically means, if I'm in Alaska, my mother's in Idaho, she comes up to visit me, has a stroke, her powers of attorneys from Idaho will be recognized readily up here for a medical professional. He or she does not have to go and try to figure out if which one of the three children has gotten the power. Is this Idaho power of attorney, health powers acceptable? This document addresses that. It also recognizes powers of attorneys of the, and if my mother was in a business partner and wanted to come up to Alaska, the two of them together, and do purchase of, say, furs or something, and my mother has a stroke, it allows that person to handle business things on their behalf. We'll facilitate business, it'll facilitate community and family relationships, and we just wanted to go on record of support of that, those provisions.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, Darlin, is that right? What's that?
Marie Darlin,
yeah. It's hard to read that. But I knew from your signature who it was. Can't sneak up on me. I've seen you before.
For the record, my name is Marie Darlin, and I'm representing AARP of Alaska. And I want to say, by way of a bit of history, that this is actually continuing the work that was started several years ago, which actually took us 4 years to accomplish, which was the Advanced Directives Bill, which did some of the same kinds of things as what this now has added to and clarified a lot. And so we definitely support this bill. Figure it's one more step in the right direction to help protect our vulnerable adults. And as you've already heard a lot of testimony, we know it's a problem. This is one way to try and correct some of those things that have occurred so that we have a better definition for everybody about what it is they're doing when they sign, what specific powers they are going to give away, which before was not really demanded, because if you wanted, you could sign for all of the above, and that took care of everything. This time, they're going to have to do some thinking about what kinds of things are they going to, you know, assign to somebody else. So anyway, we are in full support of the bill and feel that it really is a step further forward from what we had worked on before. And I think that takes care of it.
Thank you. That concludes everybody that signed up. If there's anybody that wants to say anything, I don't see anybody coming forward. So that'll conclude our public hearing on this bill. We'll have the bills. What did you want to come up? Come on forward.
I'm not going to. For the record, my name is Denise Daniello, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I thought I signed up.
Well, you did.
He was on the wrong form.
Yeah. Darlin, I thought that was her, but the last name, but the first name didn't match, and I knew she was going to want to testify, so I was just having a heck of a time here today.
Looked at my name and
well, it's
fine. I just want to reinforce the testimony that you've previously heard about this bill. We are in support of making the power of attorney statute more current. We feel it's especially important in light of the increasing senior population, particularly the number of people who are the oldest old, people who are 85 years and older, who oftentimes are the most at risk for financial exploitation because of their health conditions and cognitive disabilities. And we particularly like the fact that the statute is being brought up to conform with the Uniform Power of Attorney Act to make our laws interstate compatible. We also like the Substitute Decision-Making Act that was incorporated into the new version of the Power of Attorney. And also, we highly support increasing the principal's control in their decision-making regarding the powers that they'll be delegating. So we are in support of this legislation, and pending its passage, I just wanted to make note that we believe that some educational effort be made to the public to let them know about the changes in the power of attorney form and statute, and to let them know that they can update their power of attorney form if they so choose. However, the existing one would still be valid, and we can help with that effort. Thank you.
I do apologize for not picking your name up right away, because I know you and Darlin have testified numerous times on all kinds of bills, and you don't show up unless you have something to say. So that concludes our public hearing on this bill. Do we have the bill sponsor come forward? Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor before we set the bill aside? Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, not a question so much as a thank you to Representative Hughes. The content of this bill is quite relevant in my personal life related to family relatives, and I appreciate what you've done with it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll set this bill aside for further review. Next up, Senate Bill 72. By Senator Giesel. If she could introduce herself for the record, we know who she is, and then take us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N as in November. So Senate Bill 72 kind of follows along the same theme we've been looking at with assisting folks that that need our assistance. This bill would improve the post-discharge health outcomes by improving coordination with designated caregivers when someone is discharged from the hospital. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. Had a family member, in my personal experience, a senior family member, discharged from the hospital who needs additional care. And when that happens, sometimes family members are picking up that care and they have no idea how to change a dressing, how to give certain medications. This bill would address that. Approximately 88,000 Alaskans at some time are needing caregiving services in their home. And the more we can keep these folks at home and keep them recovering from whatever reason they were in the hospital, of course, we lower health care costs. Readmissions are expensive. And in fact, hospitals will be penalized for readmissions going forward. So this just would require that when someone is admitted to the hospital, the name of a caregiver is provided to the hospital staff. This is the person I designate to take care of me when I'm discharged. The designated caregiver would have to consent to accepting that responsibility. Then the designated caregiver would be notified when the patient is going to be discharged, either to another facility or back home. And that notification would be as soon as possible, as soon as reasonably possible. Then the hospital would consult with the caregiver concerning the discharge plan and would make sure that designated caregiver had been educated in how to take care of their loved one. So it's really kind of a practical bill we've heard multiple stories of folks, family members, who have accepted or been given the responsibility of caring for this family member and have just felt lost and overwhelmed. So this bill would address that. My staff, Jane Conway, is here to take you through a sectional if you are interested, Mr. Chairman.
If you could, please. I think we'll take a few minutes here. Yeah.
For the record, my name is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. We'll go through the sectional analysis that was provided to you in your packets. Section 1 amends 1820 by adding a new section, caregivers of hospital patients after discharge. Section 1820-500 names a caregiver. It gives the patient the opportunity to name a caregiver to provide aftercare following discharge and outlines the details of that process. Section 1820-510 is in regard to the release of medical information. This provides the hospital to ask for a patient's consent to release their medical info to the caregiver, allows the patient to prohibit the release of the medical records, thereby releasing the hospital from its obligation to notify or inform a caregiver. Section 1820-520, notice to named caregiver, requires the hospital to notify the named caregiver of the plan discharge date and or the time of transfer to another facility as soon as reasonably possible. Section 1825-30, caregiver not being obligated. This section says that if a person is named by the patient as the caregiver, that person does have the right to refuse that designation. The next section is on the discharge plan. It requires the hospital to prepare a discharge plan and assesses the named caregiver's skills to provide the prescribed aftercare. It outlines what needs to be included in the plan and provides a hospital contact or hospital contractor contact who can answer questions the caregiver might have about their aftercare tasks. Section 1820-550 requires a hospital or the contractor to instruct a named caregiver on the tasks outlined in the discharge plan. This section also talks about that the instruction must be culturally sensitive and comply with federal law. It requires that the training be done before the discharge, if possible, unless that would delay the discharge. And in that event, the training should take place as soon as possible after the patient's discharge. Section 1820-560, this section outlines what must be recorded in the patient's medical record. Section 1825-65, no delay of discharge or transfer. This section provides that the required caregiver instruction cannot delay a patient's discharge or transfer to another facility. It's not meant to be a hindrance to the efficiency of a hospital in getting their patients discharged. 1825-70 states the provisions of this bill do not create a liability for the hospital, a hospital contractor or employee for their performance or non-performance of the tasks outlined in this bill. 1825-80, the provisions in this bill do not override the duties of an agent under an advanced health care directive or the powers or duties of a legal guardian. 1825-585 is about regulations. It gives the department the authority to write regulations to carry out provisions of the bill. The next section is 10 definitions of terms used in the bill. Section 2, a new section that gives Department of Health and Social Services the authority to adopt regulations necessary to implement, and that the regulation will take effect on January 1st, 2016. Section 3 allows the department to begin the regulation process immediately, and the effective date is January 1, 2016, which may have to be amended at this point. Right. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the sectional analysis. Thank you.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor before we go to the public hearing? Seeing none, we'll go to the public hearing. We've got five outside the room and four inside the room. So we'll go ahead and start with the off-net. You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and then speak to the bill, please. I'd like to start with Ann Lovejoy.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ann Lovejoy. I work for Mountain Pacific. We're the Quality Improvement Organization for the state of Alaska. We're under contract with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And I support this bill, or we support this bill, for two reasons. One, it is beneficial for people. And secondly, it is beneficial for the health industry as a whole. Let me take the first point. In terms of how it benefits people, frequently people, individuals who are in the hospital are discharged without real clear roles and responsibilities for who will deliver their aftercare. So one of the drivers for high readmission rates and also for very poor health outcomes is that individuals do not receive the necessary aftercare. Generally speaking, if they can name someone to help them, and if that person then receives education to actually deliver care, you know, administer medications, change dressings, do the sorts of things that are necessary to make sure that the person continues to heal, then that individual is benefited. Secondly, the readmissions is a very important issue because the industry right now is receiving negative payment adjustments, a so-called penalty for excessively high rates of readmissions. Generally speaking, if a hospital took the extra time to educate the caregiver, then those readmission rates would go down. We know this because there are some hospitals in this state that do a very good job with patient and caregiver education, and then there are others which do less well. The benefit to the industry, therefore, is they would be less likely to have the payment adjustments. They would be less likely to have adverse events happen to their patients. And then the third thing is that their accreditation would be reassured, because right now the accreditation for hospitals with Joint Commission and with other accrediting bodies currently specifies that aftercare education must be done. And so this is just a way of making sure that what should be done is being done better. In other words, that the roles and responsibilities of those caregivers is clear, that the patient education is specifically delivered as it should be. This bill does not put any individuals in the industry into a straitjacket. It's not mandating what should be said. It just says that education must be done. So for those two reasons, to benefit human beings and the people that we love in the state, I believe that SB 72 should be supported, and it also will benefit our industry because it will make sure that what should be done will be done. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lovejoy. Debbie Rutherford from MATSU.
Yes, thank you. My name is Debbie Rutherford. I live in the MATSU, and I'm calling to support SB 72 and thank Senator Kathy Geisel for her leadership on this. I'm someone who just experienced this issue, and as the person before me said, this is not something that the things outlined in this bill are things that ought to be being done anyway, but the fact is they're not, for whatever reason. I had a senior relative in the hospital with a serious and sudden illness, and this is an intelligent person and, in fact, a retired medical field person, and called me in a panic saying, they say they're sending me home today. You know, I don't feel ready. I'm confused. So I had to race to the hospital. I had to find someone. I had to get information. My loved one and her spouse were confused and unsure about why she was going home so soon, what needed to be done. She still seemed so weak and needs so much care. And, of course, the spouse was elderly also. It was care that was probably beyond that person's ability. I had to run around and find these things out. As it was, there were three readmissions after that point. And I'm not saying that this bill would have prevented those readmissions, but it might have. Even as it was, I didn't get all my questions answered. I was sent home with two pages of medications, and it was just a printout, two pages of medications with, I'm pretty good with medical jargon, but I really had to read and reread them and to figure out which ones were replacing medications she was already on and which ones were new ones and how many times a day, and I really had to study it and then create my own chart, and I had all sorts of questions. And I knew her doctors. I was able to call people, and I just think about people who didn't, who may not have an advocate that's right there. They may not have thought they needed one. This will force the question. It will say, it will have the hospital be required to say right up front, you know, these people are very sick, even if they aren't seniors or have no dementia or anything. When you're very sick, your brain is just a little addled. So it allows them to say, yes, now that you mention it, let's put so-and-so down as the other person who hears all this information, because I don't think I'm going to remember it. And oftentimes it's not the spouse. The spouse isn't the best person because they either may be elderly or they may be in a very emotional panicked situation at the moment also, and they're not thinking as clearly either. So it's just so important for the stress level of the patient and the family, and as was mentioned, I really believe it would cut down on readmissions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Rutherford, for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Victoria Martin, please.
Hello. Hi. Hello.
Hello, Victoria, if you can introduce yourself.
Hello. I'm you. Hello.
Victoria, we can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me? Sorry. Yes, good afternoon. My name is Victoria Martin. I am born in the territorial days of Alaska, and I just got through with taking care of a young lady who was my daughter's friend. Both had Down syndrome. And Janet, the young lady that I took care of with dementia, it was a year and a half. And I had no instructions on how to care for her. It was humiliating for her because she became incontinent. I hope that my story will touch your hearts, and I wish that this wasn't only just a discharge from the hospital, but when doctors recognize the patient has dementia, that they provide help, as in educating them on how to take care of someone with dementia. And because I received, in over 2 years of hard caregiving, I didn't even know I could get medical supplies through Medicaid. I am disabled. I'm a senior. When Janet didn't want to do something, she would go to the floor. And, you know, I experienced a weight loss, which was good, you know. Like, I lost 60 pounds over a two-year period. And my nerves were fried. I had no support from my family. They were all down in the States. I just were a state too, but what I'm saying is this bill is really necessary. A caregiver needs to be educated. I cannot tell you how I suffered. I did pass before Christmas. I hope in some way my testimony will touch your hearts. And you will, I don't know if any of the committee members or senators have had someone in their family with dementia. I hope not. But I just don't want to see another person go through the nightmare that I went through. And I ask you and urge you to please pass this bill, Senate Bill 72, to provide education and help to us caregivers and family members who are facing this responsibility, you know. So that's it. And I thank you for letting me testify today.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Victoria. The bill sponsor is a territorial baby, and the chairman's a territorial baby. Mm-hmm. So you're not...
I wasn't born fast enough.
And then, yeah, then. So, anyway, there's a few of us around. That takes care of the off net. We'll go to the Matt Sue. Terry Snyder, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Snyder. I'm a resident of Palmer, and I serve as the state president of AARP. Thank you in advance for allowing me to testify today in support of SB 72. First, I would like to thank Senator Giesel for her leadership in bringing this important bill forward for all Alaskans, and especially seniors. There are over 88,000 non-paid or lay caregivers in Alaska, and all of us either are, have been, or will be a caregiver at some time in our life. It may come as a surprise to many of us that family caregiving is more than just household chores and rides to the doctor. Family caregivers are often asked to perform medical nursing tasks such as medication changes, wound care, operating medical equipment, nebulizers, and more that can quickly become part of a daily routine. Most older persons with long-term care needs, 65%, rely exclusively on family and friends to provide assistance. Within our complex system of long-term care, especially women caregiving is essential in providing the backbone of that support. A percentage of women 55 and older continue to increase in the Alaskan workforce. These are women that are often taken out of that workforce to provide care for spouses, parents, parents-in-laws, friends, and neighbors, and they play many roles while caregiving: hands-on health provider, care manager, friend, companion, surrogate, decision maker, and advocate. The nearly inevitable disruption in employment is costly to business and oftentimes can result in the caregiver's own poverty. It is essential that the patient and the caregiver are provided with information that fosters confidence, skill, and successful outcomes that in fact will save healthcare dollars in care delivery, and those caregivers that can are able to return to the workforce. As the baby boomers age, they will move from providing care to needing it, and because the next generation is smaller, the demand for and on family caregivers is sure to increase. In order to successfully address the challenges of a surging population of seniors and others who have significant needs for long-term services and support, the state must develop methods to enable caregivers to continue to support their loved ones at home and in the community, and avoid costly hospital readmissions. This bill will benefit Alaskans of all ages and will support the patient and the caregiver with information that fosters confidence, skill, and successful outcomes. It will continue to save healthcare dollars in care delivery and potentially fewer hospital readmissions, and it will not cost the state additional dollars. Again, thank you for listening to my testimony today. I urge you to do as I do and lend your full support to SB 72 and the Designated Caregivers Act.
Thank you for your testimony, Terry. Next up, we'll go down to Ketchikan to the LIO, Ed Zastrow.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Zastrow. I live at 3530 Denali here in Ketchikan. And yes, I am in total support of SB 72. Ketchikan General, or Peace Health as we know it today, has a release program somewhat similar to that program that you folks have outlined in SB 72. And it works. Having total knee replacement of both knees and with a total recovery of the knees, thanks to excellent discharge practices, the recovery went well. But, however, to make this happen, prior to my release, an inspection of my home by a staff member of Peace Health was conducted. As to how many stairs there was to get into my home, did I have a hand railing and could I do that? Could I physically get around within my home because I have a multi-level home? My bathroom, were grab bars available? And the list went on. But most important, my wife, is my caregiver, was schooled and informed as to what would be required of her to assist me during my recovery. However, on the other hand, I have witnessed at our senior center that several discharges did not go as well. As an example, with a senior sitting at the table, several bottles of meds before him that he had just received, was confused as to when, how many, and what time he should take them. He had the discharge paper in his hand, but his previous testimony said it was a total confusion to him. Asked, "Do you have any help at home that could help you so you don't get mixed up with these heart meds?" His answer, "No." I feel that this bill will address this type of a situation, and I thank you folks for allowing me the time to testify before you.
Thank you, Ed. And we might see you this weekend, maybe.
I hope so.
Okay. Next up, we're going to go into the room. We're going to mix it up because it's late in the afternoon and the end of the week, and we're going to do something different here. We're going to take everybody in row two except for workers. And both, but we're going to start on the right-hand side. Again, you're here left. We don't want anybody falling asleep in here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Senator Giesel, for this bill. My name is Ken Helander. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP Alaska. I've spent nearly 40 years working professionally with older people and their families. I've worked in both hospitals and long-term care facilities, and I was a family caregiver for my own parents. SB 72 is about caregivers. It's tempting to look at the bill and see the requirements that it places on hospitals, but it is really about caregivers. As has already been mentioned, in Alaska, at any given moment, there are 88,000 family caregivers or unpaid caregivers. This doesn't include home health agencies and other paid-type caregivers. These are family members. And over the course of a year, about 128,000 people in Alaska serve in that role to some degree. This represents over $1 billion worth of care that is provided by family members that would otherwise be borne likely by the state. I want to make reference to an article that was in yesterday's Fairbanks Daily News Miner that covered the annual cost of care report from Genworth Financial, which tracks the costs of long-term care across the country. The rate of increase of nursing homes is accelerating about 4% every year over the last 5 years. Right now, on average in the United States, 1 year in a nursing home now costs nearly as much as 3 years of tuition at a private college. In Alaska, we have the highest nursing home costs in the nation, almost by twice as much as the next most expensive, which is Connecticut. In Alaska, the average cost is $281,415. That's an extraordinary amount for any family. The degree to which we can support family caregivers saves all of us and saves families the indignity, the cost, and certainly our state budgets, the cost of this bill. Last month, we at AARP conducted a telephone survey of 800 Alaska registered voters of the age 45 and over to hear about their experiences in caregiving. Among the findings, 56% identified themselves as being a current or former caregiver. 50% said it was likely they would provide care for a friend or a family member in the future. The average Alaska family caregiver is over 55 years old, female, works full or part-time in addition to caregiving, and cares for someone over the age of 73. All Alaskan family caregivers face challenges. 63% reported feeling emotionally stressed. 55% reported being stressed trying to balance both job and family caregiving responsibilities. 50% find it hard to get enough rest. 69% use their own money to help out. 69% manage medications. 67% handle nursing and medical tasks. They've also said it's important for family caregivers and their older loved ones to have support specifically around community resources to support staying at home, 88%. 90% said that they appreciated community services so family caregivers can take a break. 78% said resources and training should be available for family caregivers. 7 in 10 Alaska caregivers indicated that a loved one or a family member was hospitalized during a period of time while they were providing care. Of those caregivers, 4 in 10 say they did not receive a live demonstration or instruction of any medical tasks that they would need to perform after discharge. 95% said hospitals should demonstrate medical and nursing tasks to the caregivers. 91% said hospitals should keep family caregivers informed of major decisions and the discharge. And 82% said hospitals should have a record of who the family caregivers are in the chart. While discharge plans are required to be written and discussed with patients prior to discharge, these plans are, as has already been noted, very complex, increasingly, and like an overwhelming list. They do not accomplish the support the caregiver needs, like demonstrated instruction. We know that hospitals in Alaska are aware of the need to improve the transition from hospital care to home, and some are already working hard to do so, as Mr. Zastrow and Ketchikan talked about. And we appreciate that, and so do family caregivers. Some hospitals are not making the same effort, and they need the incentive provided by SB 72. This bill will strengthen caregivers for the long haul and save state dollars. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill to support Alaska's family caregivers.
Thank you, Ken. We'll go right down the row until we hit the wall. You don't want to testify? Okay. It was just the way the names were listed on the list. It just lined up on row two on both sides.
So again, for the record, my name is Denise Daniello, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I think you have heard a lot of strong support for this bill and for the importance of family caregivers in caring for their loved ones at home, whether they be seniors, people with disabilities, people of all ages. I think this is a really, the Commission feels that this is a very important bill. We like a lot of aspects about the bill, the fact that it improves coordination with the person's designated caregiver and the hospital, that provides a procedure for assessing that caregiver's abilities to perform those aftercare tasks, the fact that it will provide instruction and training for the caregiver, and at the end of the day, this will help older adults who are cared for by competent caregivers to remain in their homes and communities for as long as possible. So, as we all know, the senior population is growing, especially the numbers of people who are elderly, people age 85 and older, who rely increasingly more on their family caregivers. And so the more that we can do to support our family caregivers with training and other supports, the better able they're going to be able to do their jobs and to hold down state spending. Thank you.
Thanks, Denise. And now we'll go to the other side of the room on row two. And that is will be everybody that signed up, and there's only two other people in here that aren't that normal. I shouldn't say normally here, but aren't around the building all the time. So if you guys want to testify after Becky's done, that'd be fine. If not, that's fine too.
Good afternoon. For the record, Becky Holtberg. I'm the CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Spent this morning in House Finance talking about the problem of health care costs, and I'm going to spend the afternoon or a few minutes here with you asking you to please not help us to improve that problem and not exacerbate it. First of all, I want to thank Senator Giesel. I want to thank Jane for working with us on this bill. It is not at a point where we can support it, so ASHNA is opposing this bill. However, we are willing to continue to work with the sponsor and staff in the interim. We resolved a number of problems. I think there are some that we could, with more work, reach resolution on. Our association and our members are very concerned about successful transitions from hospital to home or another care environment. Discharge planners work daily to write discharge plans. Floor nurses, physicians, and others daily work to educate caregivers on providing appropriate follow-up care. This work is happening, and in fact, I think you heard from Mr. Zastro from Ketchikan about an example where the process worked really well. A couple of the other testifiers talked about things that, quite frankly, this bill would not address. The biggest problem that we hear from our chief nurse executives is the lack of a caregiver. Not necessarily that the caregivers were not educated, but they can't find a caregiver for a patient. This bill would not address that problem. This bill also does not address many of the problems that do occur over the course when someone has a chronic disease that are far beyond the discharge planning process. But in general, I want to note that our concerns about setting into statute specific patient medical interactions, documentation, and specific discharge procedures. Once set in statute, and we know statute is not flexible, to come back and change statute is significant. But setting into statute something like this does not provide for change in process. It does not provide for the ability to keep up with new medical evidence. It does not provide for the ability to adopt new technology and innovation. So we're very concerned about the precedent of putting these specific patient interactions into statute. In addition, there's a great deal of variety in hospitals across Alaska. We have very small, isolated critical access hospitals and all the way up to very large tertiary care facilities in Anchorage. We're asking them, imposing the same standard on these facilities regardless of their size or capacity. We're also concerned about the discrepancies between the CARE Act legislation, Joint Commission requirements, and the Medicare conditions of participation, which apply to all patients, not simply Medicare beneficiaries. Essentially, what we're setting in place here is a fourth level of regulation on an existing process. We have Joint Commission, Medicare conditions of participation, state licensure requirements, and this would add a fourth level of administrative regulation to an existing process. Our nurse leaders tell us that they work hard. They're working daily with their teams to improve discharge planning processes. We want to focus on improving patient care, and we want to focus on improving quality. And if we are diverting resources into record keeping and into additional administrative burdens, we are not able to put those resources into improving patient care. So I want to talk through just a couple of specifics, and I know I have limited time, so a couple of specific concerns we have about the legislation. One is that hospitals are required to contact and confirm the name, telephone number, et cetera, of a caregiver within a reasonable time. So essentially we have nurses who are working to provide patient care now required to both collect and then contact and follow up and make sure they've contacted a caregiver. While this sounds insignificant, when you're adding layer upon layer of burden to a caregiver or to someone who is caring for a patient, it's not insignificant if you have a number of patients and you're required to do this. Hospitals are required to assess the caregiver's ability to provide aftercare for the patient. This could be very challenging. It's really not right now the job of a hospital necessarily to assess the capability of the caregiver. Now, in certain situations, of course, it's obvious that the caregiver may not be able. But what about if there are behavioral health issues? What if there, as I had someone say to me, there was a real situation where someone had a substance abuse issue that at that point, what is the hospital supposed to do if this is the designated caregiver? And that's what the patient has asked to occur. There's no explanation of what the hospital's obligation is under that scenario. So there are also concerns about how hospitals will provide instruction as soon as possible after discharge. Once a patient is discharged, that patient is connected to the appropriate community resources in order to receive follow-up care. It should be a primary care, essentially a primary care physician or other specialist doing the follow-up care, but we are now transferring that burden to the hospital. Hospitals are required to document and instruct caregivers, but caregivers have no accountability to acknowledge or accept that instruction. And there's the situation could occur where a patient designates someone who's not necessarily willing to be the caregiver, and that kind of puts the hospital in the middle. Language is also unclear in the bill about who provides the instruction. And again, we want to make sure that whatever the means are, that there's the opportunity to provide that instruction, not necessarily face-to-face. Sometimes it can be in other ways. Hospitals are also required to promptly record information in the patient's medical record. It is unclear to us if all of the existing electronic health records will be able to capture the information as it is specifically identified in the bill. The Alaska eHealth Network, which was a state-funded project to make sure electronic medical records can talk to each other, has estimated that this could cost them about $100,000 to ensure that they can capture this information. So I think there's some additional work to be done in ensuring that there's not going to be a significant cost burden in the electronic health record. So if there's the concepts in these bills have been identified as nationally by AARP as a priority. There are many other states working on this legislation now. Some versions have passed, others are under development. So I think as we see what is happening in other states, we'll have the opportunity to identify how we can support the intent of this bill, which we certainly do. We certainly support the intent of the bill without adding administrative burden that is not necessarily going to result in different outcomes than we have today. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, we're happy to continue to work on this bill with AARP and the sponsor. We understand the intent. We agree with the intent. But we do have concerns about some of the specific language in the bill.
Okay, we have about 6 minutes left. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a real quick question. Ms. Holberg referenced conversations and concerns by nursing professionals. Do you know if the nurses have expressed these through their own organization? Every once in a while, the administrators and nurses have differences of opinions on policy and issues.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we have a committee within our association that is comprised of chief nurse executives or directors of nursing. So these would be the nurses in an administrative capacity. That's the group we've consulted and received feedback. We have not consulted with the nursing association, just within our own association.
Thank you. I just wanted that clarification.
Any other questions for Ms. Holbert? Okay, none. Thank you. That concludes our public hearing. Seeing nobody else with enthusiasm to jump up in the last 5 minutes, we'll bring it back to the committee. Any final comments from the bill sponsor?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for continued work. I've talked with the bill sponsor. We'll hold it over the interim and see if we can't iron out some of these issues. We are adjourned.